Rony Zone Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to Rony Zone Radio number 17. We have another great show. I always say that, but it's true. And this show, we're going to cover a topic that most people just don't want to talk about. And there is a friend of mine at work that I knew would shed some very astute light on the subject. And he's somebody that I really enjoyed talking to, spending time with, and he's just a great guy. And we're going to meet him in a little bit, and we're going to talk about homelessness. We're going to talk about how it happens, what our response is to it. We're going to talk about some plans to begin now to maybe help the problem. We talk about the government's hand in it, how it can help. We talk about faith-based initiatives and faith-based organizations to help out. We cover a lot of ground tonight. And I hope you learn something, and I hope it affects you in some way. Because really, whether you realize it or not, homelessness affects all of us. And now, let's meet Michael.
Welcome back, everybody, to Rony Zone Radio. I have someone here with me who I respect very highly. Very intelligent gentleman and a really nice guy.
Like to introduce another guest?
No.
Okay.
No. I'd like to introduce Michael. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about something that means a lot to me. And it is going to be, I'm thinking, a very revealing look at an issue that's all around us. And the question I want to start with is, where did you sleep last night? Where did you sleep?
I slept in my hotel room here at the Westin.
Okay.
In Costa Mesa.
Okay.
And you know, hotel rooms are pretty much my home at this point. So
sure.
I slept at home.
Okay. I slept in a nice bed.
It's a very nice bed.
Probably the nicest mattress there is.
Wonderful.
Was it comfortable at night for you?
Extremely.
Okay, good. Where did you eat? How many times did you eat yesterday?
Yeah.
Yesterday, I ate twice.
Okay.
I ate lunch.
Okay.
I ate dinner. Where did I eat? In my room.
Okay.
Had room service. Somebody actually brought me food, set it down in front of me. I ate it, and they took it away.
Okay. Wow.
I don't think it gets any better.
No, that's true. I had three meals yesterday.
Three. So one-third more than me.
That's correct. Do you have health care?
I do have health care, although it's very minimal health care. I pay for my own. It's what I call catastrophic health care.
Okay.
So it's like...
But you're a very, very healthy guy. You eat very healthy. You take care of yourself. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Except for my occasional vices, but yeah.
Okay.
Generally speaking, yes.
I also have health care as well.
With the company.
And with the company, that's right. And I pay my monthly allotment, and I have health care. We'll be getting back to this, but let's switch gears, and let's talk about, generally, when someone walks up to a homeless person, and the homeless person asks them for money, what is the response in their mind? What would you say?
Well, complex discussion, definitely, but I think, generally speaking, I think that people are immediately off-put by the physicality of that person. They're dirty, they're smelly, they're probably inebriated in some form, or obviously, or have been at some point. So they're pretty off-put and offended and just really want to get as far away from that person as quickly as possible. That's the normal reaction, I think. Occasionally, I think there's a situation where something about a person actually speaks to the person and they connect in some way that the person actually gives them some money for one reason or another. But generally speaking, I think people are pretty off-put by homelessness.
Okay. I'll put some words in their mind just for our conversation. They're alcoholics.
Yep.
They're drug addicts.
Yep.
They're lazy.
Yep.
They may have mental issues. And so a person that sees someone who is disheveled, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe have clothes that don't match.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
definitely.
A beard, probably smells. There's a lot of different faces that they put on them. Oh, they're this, oh, they're that, oh, they're this, oh, they're that. And they ask for money and they say, I'm not giving that person my money because they're going to go and buy whatever, whatever.
Or even if they don't think they're going to go out and buy whatever, it's more like, you know, I worked very hard today for the money I have in my pocket, and I'll be damned if I'm going to give it away to you.
Right.
Sort of thing. And the person, I think, to a lot of people, I think instinctually, viscerally, that person represents the anti-them. It's everything that they aren't.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that people intuit somehow that, you know, when they really think about it, that it is them at their very worst.
Mm.
And it's almost like they don't want to connect with that, with the possibility that they have any tie with that person at all.
Mm.
It's just like almost a physical impossibility. They want it to seem in their own mind that they could be that person.
Getting back to where we started, you and I are probably two of the luckiest guys walking around.
Yep.
We have a job that offers us health care. We, at this point, are software trainers where the company puts us up in very nice hotels, pays us to eat, gives us allowance for cars. We want for very little. And
let's
expand it out. America is the richest country
in the world.
In the world. And we have these little stepchildren that we don't want to really look at. We don't want to acknowledge that.
And that, you know, you can extrapolate that out to other countries. I mean, I think poor countries to Americans, sort of the same phenomena. It's almost like homelessness. It's a homeless country. When you see poor countries, you see the things that go on in, I mean, name a country, Pakistan, Costa Rica, you know, that level of poverty. They really see a complete disconnect. They want to see a complete disconnect between themselves and that. There is no, how could you put it, dialectical relationship, for lack of a better, simpler term.
It's incredible to me, as we look around, this is a beautiful hotel we're in right now. We're in the Westin Hotel in Costa Mesa, California. Beautiful hotel. And yet, I don't think you would have to drive 5 blocks and you could fight someone who is homeless.
Oh, absolutely.
That needs some kind of help. And there's a lot of reasons that people become homeless. One is that the poverty level in someone who works in a certain type of job, it just doesn't make enough to pay rent. The rent is so high, especially here in Orange County. I would say everywhere, rent is high.
Yes,
and
relatively speaking.
The type of jobs that you could possibly get is tough to make the rent.
Yeah.
Buy clothes, car, now gas, health care, all those rolled in together. It's tough.
And everything has its own inertia, I think. I mean, just like the things that make people that have things, very successful people, there was an inertia that most people were born into, and they kind of fell into that inertia and were carried away by it. And a lot of it's their own initiative, but a lot of it was the circumstances that they were born into that, you know, allowed them to, that created a situation for that initiative to actually bear success.
Mm-hmm.
Exact same thing with poor people and homelessness. You get on a downward spiral, and once you get on it, it's very hard to get out of it. And homelessness is the bottom rung of that spiral. There are many, many, many extremely poor people, extremely needy people who are not homeless, but are right on the edge. Any little bump in the road, any little thing that would happen could make them be homeless, and they live in, you know, a state of kind of terrorized desperation all the time that's going to happen. So, yeah, I mean, it's... we get into little cycles and they take on their own momentum, and breaking out of that cycle is, especially for a poor person, is extremely difficult.
We'll get to that in a little bit.
Okay.
There are a lot of reasons why people become homeless. There is addictions, whether it's drugs, alcohol, whatever that umbrella entails. There's also mental illness. If someone has a mental illness, it is difficult for them to have extended care unless the family will step up and take that role and responsibility. But they have jobs and families as well. this is a very different environment than, let's say, in the Middle East Bible times, let's say. They were very much family-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
They had extended families that lived in tents, and they would, as Bedouins, wander, move, and take their whole families with them. Hawaii and the Oriental countries and areas, they also have the extended family of the Hispanic folks here, the same type of situation where they have the entire family. But it's funny that the Caucasian American folks are breaking away from that and just saying, no, it's me and my wife and my child. That is my family. Now, maybe in the South, here in America, it's different. Maybe they do have extended families. But it's just kind of an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah. Well, we live in an individualistic society. I mean, definitely, and the individual is celebrated in society, almost deified in a sense that it's me against the world. And there's a lot of good things about that. I mean, it's a place where individuals can come and succeed based on their own individual initiative and intelligence and native skills and all of that. But by the same token, if you don't, then you truly are. It is against you against the world, so to speak. And I think that kind of basic ethos about how we approach life has permeated this entire society as the United States. I think it's probably generally true of Western industrialized countries, but not to the extent that it is here. This country somehow has really kind of purified the individualistic strain and the relying on that. And to the extent that when we look at homelessness and phenomena like that, there is a complete disconnect. It's like people are saying, well, that's what they've made of their lives.
Right.
And I think what troubles me about that whole thing is people in this country do not see the relationship between the top and the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see that their success is born to some degree on the failure of other people's. And you could extrapolate that out to foreign countries. People don't see in this country that the poverty in much of the third world is a direct reflection of the wealth of the non-third world. And they see that as sort of like the same sort of thing. Well, they're just really poor countries, we're rich countries, and it's not our fault that they're poor. But there are relationships.
Let's take a step in. You and I had a conversation the other day about the corporate country versus a compassion based country or area. Let's talk about that.
Well, you know, what I was saying was that, you know, for lack of a much more complex discussion, we have a capitalist society here, and all, you know, at this point, all of the world is capitalistic, basically. I mean, you can talk about China, and you can talk about Cuba and different examples like that, but generally speaking, I think it's a capitalistic system. And I think what's happened in this country is because of that individualistic focus and because it's taken on a real kind of like purified form of extreme individualist attention, that it's become a brutal form of capitalism. It's become much more brutal than it needs to be. I mean, you can look at countries like Sweden and France and even England and different places. Almost any other Western industrialized country that you can point to has a much higher level of societal, state-centered compassion institutionalized into their societies that ameliorates to one degree or another some of the things we're talking about. I mean, they all have the same problems. They all have homelessness. They all have poverty. But they've taken the edge off the extremes of it, and they've created conditions that allow for people to have a basic maintenance level of life. And those conditions have been created by the very forces that control those societies. They have less. I mean, the rich people in these countries, taxes in France, for example, are astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
Rich people pay unbelievable taxes in France, but they reap a lot of benefits. They reap the benefits of really beautiful, well-maintained cities, and they also reap the benefits of those extreme levels of deprivation and poverty not existing to the extent they do in this country. They certainly do exist.
Sure.
But it's a different ethos. It's a different way that they look at life. There is more of a group mentality, more of a, how can I put it, more of a, they do see the relationship that this is one society and that we have a responsibility. And the responsibility, I think, is really born of the fact that there is that relationship. I mean, you cannot have rich people without poor people.
Right.
And so it really comes to me, it boils down to, well, do you want to have extremes of both? I mean, how rich is enough?
Right.
And how much poverty, how much extreme poverty can you stand? And, you know, when you get mugged and walking through Central Park by a really, you know, depraved, poor, you know, aberrant person, well, are you partly responsible for that, for creating conditions where they are in that situation? I mean, that's a little bit oversimplified, but I think you get the
absolutely
general thrust.
If a person is homeless, and let's talk about America as it is right now, how can they get out as far as what you're aware of? How can someone get out of that?
Well, it's tough. I mean, if you don't have help, I mean, I have a very dysfunctional, disunited family, and I came from a very poor family. So my family, generally speaking, especially my parents, had no money. When I got out of college, for example, I didn't have a job. I moved to a different city that I wanted to live in just by my own choice. And there was about 2 months when I first moved to the city, San Francisco, where I didn't have a job, I didn't have any money, and I really didn't have anybody that I could go to for money. And if I hadn't found a job at that point, it would have been quite possible for me to become homeless. It just so happened that I did have friends who were able to help me at that point. Nothing major, I mean, but, you know, $500 here, $300 there, right. When you're at that close to the edge, it makes all the difference. Well, if you don't have that situation and you do lose your job and you're not, a college-educated person who's articulate and able to kind of figure out how to, you know, do what you have to do to survive, what happens? You become homeless. You have literally nobody to go to. Literally, their families have turned their backs on them. If they have families, they don't have friends. If they do, their friends are like them, without means. And like I said, once that inertia takes on its own momentum, if they do become homeless, well, at that point, all of the things are working against them. I mean, if you really did become homeless, even for a week,
right.
Well, you haven't taken a shower. Your clothes are dirty. You're
right.
Dirty. You're stressed. You become different. Let's say you then find a situation where you could get a job. Well, where are you going to wash your clothes?
Right.
Where are you going to take a shower? Who's going to cut your hair?
Mm-hmm.
You can't go to an interview looking like that.
Right.
So all of the, everything just, it's exponential. It just takes off, and now you're rooted in it. And if you're in that situation, and many, 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 many people are,
right.
Well, how do you get out of it? If you don't have any help, and if there's no, and that's the thing that's the most bothersome, is that our society has created very minimal institutionalized establishments to spread out help to, you know, just very basic things. The current administration and a lot of, you know, and you can all go all the way back to Reagan with trickle-down economics, they tend to say, well, it really needs to start with faith-based organizations and private organizations or non-governmental organizations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and that's all good. But when you view homelessness as a generalized phenomena, things like that, individual initiatives, individual organizational initiatives, are a drop in the ocean. I mean, they do help people, but they don't help enough people to make a societal impact that really stops the bottom, eliminates that bottom rung. And it's a matter of will. I mean, if we, as you said, you know, at the beginning, there's enough wealth in this country to do anything that we want to do.
Right.
We have the will to do it. Our society could create any situation that we wanted to, but we don't. And for whatever reasons, most of that wealth that could be directed in that direction is directed toward other things like military.
Mm-hmm. True. That's right. I think the capitalist society versus compassion society, I think, is something that we all really need to take a look at, because I'm full of the individualistic impulses. I want my house, where my family is. I want my car.
Yeah, me too.
And it is a drawing to that. It's almost in the air.
Oh, absolutely.
And it permeates America. And it is, I have had the great honor to be among folks that are Christians, but they take it a different angle. And they say, if we believe what we believe, then we need to act on it. And we need to love everybody. And that means food, that means care, that means whatever that is. But it springs out of that that should be in your heart. Instead of keeping it as a gift and just kind of stuck it in your pocket, say, this is mine. Say, no, this is everybody's. And because of that, that's why I give. And it's a, I guess it could start with you and me.
Mm-hmm.
It can start now. It can start maybe by somebody who's listening to kind of change your view. Instead of looking in the mirror, looking out the window and saying, it's someone out that window that needs my help. Maybe it starts with a family that is dysfunctional. Maybe that has rock'em sock'em fights every Friday night. Maybe they need to think about Uncle whoever that needs some help. Maybe it starts there. Maybe it kind of grows from there.
Well, yeah, I agree. I mean, it really has to start on the individual level. And, you know, I'm very individualistic myself. I want all the things you just said. I want a house. I want a car. I want all my nice stuff. I definitely do. But I think the first step toward what you just described, toward that individual connection with people who are unlike you in many, many different ways, is to realize how like you everybody else is. I mean, we all have our, I mean, there's differences of every, you know, possible index you can think of, racial, economic, cultural, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing, as you know, I've traveled a lot, and one thing that traveling has taught me, and when I travel, I actually don't just travel and look, I travel and live. I live with different societies, and I speak languages, and I feel what that society is like. And the more, and even racially in this country, I'm from a mixed race parentage. My dad was black, my mom was white, and I've lived in both worlds intimately. I know them very well in this country. And the more I travel and the more I think about all of the differences, the more I get around, the more I realize how little separates us. How really 99% of us are almost identical. We all want the same things. We're all almost identical.
Right.
The little differences that we think are so huge as far as geography and culture and race and everything are so minimal. But those are the things that blind us to our likeness. And then when we get into a situation where it's pretty much, I mean, we get into these situations where we don't see a way to connect.
Mm-hmm.
There's no meaningful way to connect. And even any connection that we can see seems to be minimally effective. So why do it? Why, you know, take the chance of being, you know, hurt in that situation or being exploited or taken advantage of? But I think that when, just like what you said, I think when people really do, if they really can see that connection, they can really look at somebody and see how alike they are with that person. And like I said at the beginning, I think that's one of the things that viscerally puts people off to homelessness is they want to think that's the anti-me. Not only is that anti-me, I could never be like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could be like that so easily. I mean, well, anybody.
Let's talk about that for just a second. If somebody didn't pay you, how many months?
Yeah, how many weeks?
How many weeks?
There's an old saying in history that the world is three missed meals from anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Just think about it on a national level. Let's just say for whatever reason the electrical system went down for 6 months.
Right.
And all of the electrical information, like in bank machines and everything, was wiped out. So your bank account was wiped out by an electrical hacker of some sort of, you know, Al-Qaeda hacking attack or something like that. Well, just imagine the chaos that would ensue. I mean, look at New Orleans. That's a,
right.
I mean, it's a microcosm of what could happen, but that could happen very easily on a national level. I mean, who would have thought that an entire city could be reduced to that sort of situation in the United States of America in 2005?
Right.
Well, it would have lost your job, just that, and were not able to find another job, and ran through your safe, reduced that down quite easily. If you can think about it on that level, you can reduce it down quite easily to your own personal level. I mean, if you lost your job, just that, and were not able to find another job, and ran through your savings, whatever it would be, and just got to the bottom with no job and no resources, no help, I don't care who you are. You would sink into depravity. You would sink into homelessness. And different people handle that different ways. Or people handle it with dignity. Some people sink into, you know, different levels of addictions or whatever. But whatever level you sank into, you would be there. Mm-hmm. And you, of your own resources, by yourself, would never be able to get out of it unless you got help. And people say, well, I'd go out and get a job. Well, that's help. You know, and but how would you get a job if you, you know, if once, like I said before, just physically, if you got to the point where you literally were filthy and dirty and had no means to just change that one basic situation, how would you get a job? And what kind of job would you get? And even if you got a job in that situation, you would be like I described before. You might get yourself out of homelessness, but you would now be at that desperate level of poverty where you're just, you know, you're just barely hanging on, and any little bump in the road again could send you back. Mm-hmm. And so many millions of people live like that. The overwhelming majority of black people in this country, you know, it's one of the interesting things about race in this country is that race in this country hides poverty. Because if you take, if you kind of quantified all the poor people in this country, so let's just say, for sake of argument, 10 million poor people, there's many more, but, well, of that 10 million, probably 7 million are black, and probably 70% of black people in the United States are poor. Well, because of that, and because of the racial separation in this country, and make no mistake about it, there is a racial separation in this country. I mean, there's a lot of black people that, you know, are mixed in with white society and what have you, but they are the overwhelming minority, absolutely. You go into the black communities of Los Angeles and the Bay Area and New York, and you don't see any white people. And I know, you know, when I was a kid, I know children, black children, who had never, that were 9, 10, 11 years old, and never seen a white person in their lives except on TV. So that's the level of separation we have. Well, because of that, that masks the level of poverty that we have in this country. I heard an interesting comment when they were interviewing a white woman in New Orleans about who was going to be moving back into this deserted city, whether or not the neighbors that have been previously heretofore really poor black neighborhoods would be allowed to become black neighborhoods again. And she referred to the people in those neighborhoods as living in the black condition. What she meant was poverty, but she saw it as a racial thing. She saw it completely separate from her own reality. It's kind of funny to me that if everybody in this country were white, if nothing changed except everybody was white, people would see poverty in this country much clearer. Then they would see their relationship to it. So we are in this together. I mean, that's a prime example of how we have separated ourselves from ourselves to kind of build a cocoon around ourselves of security that is completely specious. I mean, it's such a thin line between you and all of us, anybody, and a completely different condition, completely different.
Well, it definitely is reflected in, and I get back to what I was talking about before, because I want my brothers and sisters that are listening that do affirm Christian values and biblical values. The Bible says, love your neighbor as yourself. You feed yourself, you feed your neighbor. Love one another. Love your enemies. It's a song, but red and yellow, black and white. They are all precious in God's sight. And if that's the truth, then we are all connected. No matter what your lifestyle, no matter what your color, no matter what your status, we are all connected. And I feel that we will all answer for what we do and what we don't do. And that's a harsh statement.
But
I do think that change needs to come. When we saw just people left in during the wake of Katrina.
Abandoned.
And we were relying on the government that did not come for a while.
Mm-hmm. Still hasn't.
Still hasn't. In some situations,
yes.
That should have been taken care of then by, if not the government, somebody else. And I guess that's my point. That was a wake-up call to me. That changed me. It changed me, I think, forever.
That encourages me to hear that. I think it changed a lot of people. I hear what you're saying.
And there is a again, getting back to my brothers and sisters, there's a portion in Acts 2. After all the things went on at the end, it says, and they bought and sold what they had, put it together, and shared with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's an extended family. It was in that time, the group that was in the upper room and the group that was around, they shared together. And so it gets back to the grouping. Let's start with your family.
Mm-hmm.
Is everybody okay? Is everybody taken care of? Mm-hmm. Let's pull them together. Then, do you have others that are around you? Maybe friends that need some help. Maybe somebody that you see. And if we start to get those groupings together, I think we'll see more. The bottom line is that it's better to give than receive. We miss that a lot. We want to keep everything that we've got. But I'll tell you, the most times I've been touched is when I give.
Yeah,
at Christmas time.
Yeah.
A personal thing. In our family, we have a lot of children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that we try and outgive gifts to kids.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We try and give the better toy or what they don't have. Last Christmas, I said, enough of this. I want to find people that don't have nothing in our church environment, and I want to give to them. I want to make sure that they're okay. That made me feel better than rushing around in a store trying to find Super G.I. Joe or whatever it was.
No, it's a wonderful thing. I mean, every Thanksgiving, I live right near San Francisco, but especially when I was living in San Francisco, I will go out, and I mean, I'm a person of modest means, even though I, you know, have this great job and everything. I'm deeply in debt.
Are we all?
We want to go there.
Yeah.
But I will go out and I'll buy meals, like two or three meals, and I know various neighborhoods in San Francisco where I know there's regular homeless people there who've lived there for years.
Right.
And I know them by sight, and I nod at them and say hi and what have you. I too try not to get involved in conversations with them, but you know, at various levels.
Mm-hmm.
But on Thanksgiving, I will buy meals and go and give them meals on Thanksgiving. It's a small little thing, but it's you're right. I mean, that's the ethos that we have to evolve if we're gonna survive as a species. We really do. It has to be one where we see each other as in this together, and we have to help each other. And it starts on the individual level, but it's got to become a societal will that actually has force of institutionalized force, where we actually have institutions and organizations and different things created to take care of this situation. And it will only benefit all of us. I mean, if we had a situation, just as a quick example, where we created a place where people could go and forget a place to stay, but where they could go and get a clean change of clothes, take a shower, get a haircut, be brought up to speed as far as their basic hygiene and what have you, so that they, and then could be funneled into job interviews for different, I mean, mm-hmm. just most basic elementary things, mm-hmm. just to get them established to the point where they could, you know, maintain their own well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that would be a tremendous thing, because then you wouldn't have to worry about, you know, somebody coming up to you on the street or as often and begging for money. Yes, it would cost us some, but you would be giving to them, you'd be giving to yourself. And that again would take on its own momentum. They would become more respectable people. They would start to give. Everything takes on its own momentum. And right now we're caught up in, I just think, as a society, in a very negative momentum, a very negative spiral that has us blinded to all of the things that would make us better.
People. And I don't care what you believe. I don't care what your lifestyle is. I don't care what color of your skin you are. We all need to change.
Exactly.
If you're in American borders listening to me right now, you need to change. I need to change. We need to change. And it's one thing to set up government functions and systems to do that. It's another thing to look at maybe a church, whether it's a Buddhist temple, Christian church, whatever it is, that are helping. But don't look at that and say, well, I'll give to that, and I've done my duty.
Mm-hmm.
Get involved. You do something. You do something. You get involved. I think if it changes the way we look at people, because as you said, it could be you. It might be you one day. And I think if you begin to have that mindset, hopefully it'll spread to maybe if you're in those
shoes, maybe you'll have the help.
Well, and plus, maybe. If you have that mindset, I think if enough people really get that mindset, then we can demand of our leaders that they have that mindset,
right,
and that they won't be our leaders anymore. And so we start to bring people into positions of political and social leadership who share those values. Mm-hmm. But we have to have those values before we can demand them to be shared. And I think we all do. I mean, I think American people, I think all people are really good-natured people at heart. I think Americans are very good-natured at heart. Americans are very generous people at heart. But they don't want to feel taken advantage of. And so they've been put into a situation now, I think a lot of us, where we see the negatives before we see the positives. And, you know, I think if I agree with you completely. If people start to change individually, if you really start to see just simple things, simple connections, then you see the bigger connections. And you start to demand of the people who represent you that they see those connections. And like I said, that takes on its own initiative, its own inertia.
Michael, it's been a thrill.
Ditto.
And I thank you for sharing with me and being my friend.
I'm glad there are people like you out there. It's we have, I'm sure, many differences about things that
sure.
Our politics and even our religious views and things like that, but you see how alike we are.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks again, Michael.
Thank you.
All right.
Wow. That's really all I can say. I'm the luckiest man on the face of the earth to have all this. And it's something to watch this show come from just a thought being inspired by a good friend who was doing his own show. And I said, you know, I can't do any better than that, but I think I can do something different. And just to watch this all come together is just amazing, really amazing. We've heard some sad things. We've heard some truthful things that really cut to the core. And I hope we've heard some hopefulness of what we can do. And I want to talk to all of us just for a moment. And I want to put forth a challenge to you. We have coming up pretty quick a Christmas holiday. We just passed to Thanksgiving time, but let's really focus on Christmas. Christmas is a time that a lot of different people really believe a lot of different things, and I'm going to set that aside for a second, but I'm going to say that Christmas time is normally when people come together and there is a sense of goodwill and caring and reaching out. So we'll focus on that. I think everyone who believes anything can really agree on that. And what I really challenge you to do is not only care for your own family, that's important, but I really would challenge you to do three things. I would like you to, if at all possible, give something to the Red Cross to care for the many hurricane victims. It's not just Katrina anymore. It's just a bunch of different hurricanes. We have earthquakes and fires and all kinds of catastrophes here in America and abroad. So I would humbly request that you would give to the Red Cross at Christmas time. Obviously, take care of your family. But I really think that we should pick two people that are around us that we know or we see. And I really do believe that there will be something in your heart that will tug towards a certain person. Maybe a single mom, maybe a single dad, maybe a single person. That may be a married person, a couple, whatever. But I really do think that we should really put into practice what we've talked about. And just the number two has kind of popped in my head, so let's go with two. Pick two people and be a secret Santa Get them a gift card. Get them something that is spendable pretty much anywhere and give it to them. But obviously do it in a secret way. And Do that for Christmas. Do that. Reach out. Branch out. Care for somebody that's not in your own family. Let's start now. Obviously, if you're in a church or a synagogue or kind of environment in a group like that, obviously you can do more. But I just really feel that it's important to get physically involved with another person as far as giving them something for Christmas. I think you will feel so much better doing that. On top of that, you can put together some food. I think I will get a list together of food maybe that you haven't thought about and put together little bags and drop them off instead of running away from homeless people. Have something to give them and give them food. You know, and maybe it'll be kind of a fun little driving trip. We're actually following the homeless people. Say, no, no, don't run away. I actually have something for you. Here's some food. I think they'll just about faint because they're usually not used to that kind of thing. So that's what I'm really challenging you this Christmas is reach outside of your family. Now, I'm not talking about $100. I'm not talking about a whole bunch of money. But I think something given to somebody just because you care about them and it's out of a heart of love, that's a good thing. So that's my challenge to you. And what I'd like is for you to email me back what it was like. How did it feel to actually do something for someone who you've probably never talked to maybe or never done anything like that before? How did it feel when you did that? And then also the response. I mean, obviously you can kind of tell and where it'll get around if it's in an office or something like that. But then the response. Well, what was that like? What did the people, I mean, they may find out. Obviously, the point is to do it in kind of a secret fashion, so they don't know. But what if they find you? What do they say? I really want this Christmas to be a special time for all of us. And I think if we begin to put this into focus, into action, that it'll be more of an automatic thing that we do. And anyway, that's the challenge. That's the challenge. And I thank you for listening. Okay, everybody. I have news. News for you. The dog is coming. Dwayne the Dog Bounty Hunter, that's been all over TV. He's been all over. I saw him tonight. I'm recording this Friday night. I think it's the 18th of November. I saw him tonight on the Donnie Deutsch Show on CNBC. The dog is coming. Now, the disclaimers begin. One of the toughest things about, as far as I'm concerned, doing these podcasts is that there's so much buzz and noise. The dog was on the phone with me. We had a telephone conversation. We had a telephone interview. There is a lot of buzz. I'm telling you that right now. So, the interview is coming, but there's a lot of buzz on the phone. Okay? So, what I'm going to do, my questions were very low and muddled in the buzz. So, what I'm going to do is I'm going to cut my parts out. His are okay, but there's a buzz. I'm going to re-record my questions and put them in so we'll have clear me and then a buzzy dog. Anyway, so, but I'm excited. This guy is a real deal, man. He is a real deal. And I don't think, anyway, the dog is coming. We're going to do a show about Hawaii. We're going to have another guy named Chris. He's going to tell us all about Hawaii. All about Hawaii to the point of you're going to know about the culture. You're going to know about the people. So by the time you get there, you'll get the whole system. You'll understand what it's like and why you got to wait in line and why you can't take pets there and all this kind of stuff. Oh, it's going to be cool. It's going to be awesome. So anyway, the dog and Chris is coming. We're going to do a Hawaii show. It's going to be awesome. And so gear up. Get ready. I thank you so much for listening to this show. I keep begging people to email, and I get nothing. I get zero. So either, I don't know what's going on. But email me. I guess no news is good news. I guess you guys think this is just the greatest show ever and there's nothing that can change. And I don't really think that's right. I think people have trouble with certain things. So anyway, email me today, jeff.roney@gmail.com. Or better yet, visit the website is jrd-now.com. I've really been focused a lot on putting more information in there. I've worked on the FAQ, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That site is really going to begin to kick, and it's going to really begin to just be incredible. Thanks for listening to the show. Incredible shows are coming. I am booking some things right now that will just blow your mind. And again, I'm just the luckiest guy in the world. People just keep saying yes, and it's phenomenal. So, buckle up. Continue to download the shows. Please tell all your friends. This is a very different podcast. It is not like every other show. And I think if you try and put it in a box, that's the wrong thing to do. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. Until next time, this is Jeff Roney, signing off. Roney Zone Radio.